Our reading this morning from the scriptures is from 2 Kings, continuing our studies in chapter 6 and in chapter 7. We start reading today at chapter 6 and verse 24. 2 Kings chapter 6 and verse 24. Sometime later, that is, sometime after the events that we studied last Sunday, sometime later, Ben-Hadad, king of Aram, mobilized his entire army and marched up and laid siege to Samaria. There was a great famine in the city. The siege lasted so long that a donkey's head sold for 80 shekels of silver and a fourth of a cab of seed pods for 5 shekels. As the king of Israel was passing by on the wall, a woman cried to him, "Help me, my lord the king." The king replied, "If the Lord does not help you, where can I get help for you? From the threshing floor? From the wine press?" Then he asked her, "What's the matter?" And she answered, "This woman said to me, 'Give up your son so that we may eat him today, and tomorrow we'll eat my son.' So we cooked my son and ate my son. The next day I said to her, 'Give up your son that we may eat him.' But she had hidden him. When the king heard the woman's words, he tore his robes. And as he went along the wall, the people looked, and there underneath he had sackcloth on his body. He said, 'May God deal with me, be it ever so severely, if the head of Elisha, son of Shaphat, remains on his shoulders today.' Now Elisha was sitting in his house, and the elders were sitting with him. The king sent a messenger ahead before him. But before he arrived, Elisha said to the elders, 'Don't you see how this murderer is sending someone to cut off my head? Look, when the messenger comes, shut the door and hold it shut against him. Is not the sound of his master's footsteps behind him?' While he was still talking to them, the messenger came down to him. And the king said, 'This disaster is from the Lord. Why should I wait for the Lord any longer?' Elisha said, 'Hear the word of the Lord. This is what the Lord says. About this time tomorrow, a seah of flour will sell for a shekel, and 2 seahs of barley for a shekel at the gate of Samaria.'" Quite a turnaround. The officer on whose arm the king was leaning said to the man of God, "Look, even if the Lord should open the floodgates of the heavens, could this happen?" "You will see it with your own eyes," answered Elisha, "but you will not eat any of it." Now there were 4 men with leprosy at the entrance of the city gates. They said to each other, "Why stay here until we die? If we say we'll go into the city, the famine is there and we will die. And if we stay here, we will die. So let's go over to the camp of the Arameans and surrender. If they spare us, we'll live. If they kill us, then we'll die." At dusk, they got up and went to the camp of the Arameans. When they reached the edge of the camp, not a man was there. For the Lord had caused the Arameans to hear the sound of chariots and horses and a great army. So that they said to one another, "Look, the king of Israel has hired the Hittite and the Egyptian kings to attack us." So they got up and fled in the dusk and abandoned their tents and their horses and donkeys. They left the camp as it was and ran for their lives. The men who had leprosy reached the edge of the camp and entered one of the tents. They ate and drank and carried away silver and gold and clothes and went off and hid them. They returned and entered another tent and took some things from it and hid them also. Then they said to each other, We're not doing right. This is a day of good news, and we're keeping it to ourselves. If we wait until daylight, punishment will overtake us. Let's go at once and report this to the royal palace. So they went and called out to the city gatekeepers and told them, "We went into the Aramean camp, and not a man was there, not a sound of anyone. Only tethered horses and donkeys, and the tents left just as they were." The gatekeepers shouted the news, and it was reported within the palace. The king got up in the night and said to his officers, "I will tell you what the Arameans have done to us. They know we are starving. So they've left the camp to hide in the countryside, thinking they'll surely come out, and then we will take them alive and get into the city." One of his officers answered, "Make some men take 5 of the horses that are left in the city. Their plight will be like that of all the Israelites left here. Yes, they'll only be like these Israelites who are doomed. So let us send them to find out what happened." So they selected 2 chariots with their horses, and the king sent them after the Aramean army. He commanded the drivers, "Go and find out what has happened." They followed them as far as the Jordan, and they found the whole road strewn with clothing and equipment the Arameans had thrown away in their headlong flight. So the messengers returned and reported to the king. Then the people went out and plundered the camp of the Arameans. So a seah of flour sold for a shekel, and 2 seahs of barley sold for a shekel, as the Lord had said. Now the king had put the officer on whose arm he leaned in charge of the gate, and the people trampled him in the gateway, and he died, just as the man of God had foretold when the king came down to his house. It happened as the man of God had said to the king, "About this time tomorrow, a seah of flour will sell for a shekel, and 2 seahs of barley for a shekel at the gate of Samaria." The officer had said to the man of God, "Look, even if the Lord should open the floodgates of the heavens, could this happen?" The man of God had replied, "You will see it with your own eyes, but you will not eat any of it." And that is exactly what happened to him, for the people trampled him in the gateway, and he died. Amen. And may the Lord bless to us this reading of his word.
The Old Testament, the second book of Kings, from chapter 6, verse 24, to the end of the 7th chapter. If last Sunday's message was full of humor and excitement, this week's is just as exciting, although rather different. We ended our lesson last Sunday, you may remember, with the result of Israel's magnanimity, her charity to the Syrian soldiers, you remember. The result of their kindness to the Syrian soldiers instead of killing them was that bands from Syria stopped raiding Israel's territory. And that was good, but it didn't last long. Perhaps the rascally king of Syria, whom we now know to have been Ben-Hadad, was saving his breath for a greater assault on Israel. So here it comes. The capital, Samaria, is surrounded and besieged for a lengthy period until there was the direst famine. And the people were desperately appealing to the king for help. But he was in the same situation as they were in, and he could do nothing except appeal to the Lord, visibly wearing the sackcloth of mourning next his skin. Thank goodness he thought of the Lord, Not many of these godless northern kings would have even thought of him. But at the same time, the king was blaming the Lord, and indeed the Lord's servant, the prophet Elisha, for the Syrian invasion and for this appalling siege which was reducing the people to such inhuman resorts as to boil and eat their infants. I wouldn't have mentioned that to the children. But the king's anger didn't disturb the prophet. He knew that the Syrians' invasion and siege of Samaria was a judgment upon the nation for turning away from Jehovah, their God. And he would sit on that, would Elisha, along with the elders, until the king came to his senses, if he would. So the king sent a messenger to Elisha. But before the messenger, arrived, the prophet had said to his elders, "See how this son of a murderer is sending someone to cut off my head. When he comes, shut the door, for the sound of his master's footsteps," that's the king, "is behind him." And so it was that although the language of verse 33 is confusing, and the movements of this part of the story are somewhat obscure, the king apparently overtook his servant, and it was the king himself, when he arrived, upon whom the door was slammed. That would have made the king even madder, wouldn't it? But Elisha knew how to slam doors. He also knew how to open them, didn't he? So the king, presumably standing fuming at Elisha's door, like Naaman, you remember, burst out, "This disaster is from the Lord. Why should we wait for the Lord any longer?" Now, the scholars wonder what that last remark meant. Why should we wait for the Lord any longer? Some think the king was about to capitulate to the Syrians and let them into the city to save lives. But whether that is what he meant or not, by not waiting for the Lord to lift the siege, the prophet had the answer. And the answer was, such as he gave to the king on the spot, "By this time tomorrow, food will be available in this city." Ah, but the officer attending the king said cynically, "But even if the Lord opened the floodgates of the heavens, could this happen?" Well, he should have weighed his words, shouldn't he, in the presence of this uncanny prophet of the Lord, Elisha? "Oh, yes," said the prophet, "it can happen, and it will happen, you unbeliever. And you will see it, but you won't partake of it." And of course, that sounds ominous, as we shall see. It's perhaps better not to speak unbelieving words in the presence of the Lord. He hears our words, however idly spoken. Do you remember what Jesus said about careless words? He said, "I tell you that men will have to give an account on the day of judgment for every careless word they have spoken." For by your words you will be acquitted, and by your words you will be condemned. Matthew 36. But this man suffered long before that, as we shall see, this officer of the king. But then, if what Elisha said was true, and there would be food in Samaria by that time the next day, how was it all to take place? Where was the food to come from? And of course, chapter 7 tells us in a most remarkable passage, four lepers were outside the gate of Samaria. No one would have taken any notice of them. They were to Israel less than the scum of the earth. But the poor fellows had a life, and they considered what they would do. And it is interesting that it was precisely at this point that they decided to act. And when we look at the story and Elisha's prophetic words, the two fit together with punctilious accuracy. The leper said, "There's no point in our going into the city because there is famine there, and we would eventually die. And if we stay here, we will die also. Let's go over to the Syrians and surrender to them. If they spare us, we will live, and if not, we will but die." So when it was getting dark, they crept up on the Syrians' camp. But when they reached it, there was no one there. They had fled. Why had they fled? Because the Lord produced a great sound, however it was and whatever it was, like that of a great army of horses and chariots. It must have been a prodigious sound, for the Syrians immediately concluded that an alliance of the Hittites and the Egyptians had come to support the Israeli people in Samaria and to attack them. And so they fled, leaving everything behind them. It's an amazing story. The text of the Syrians' flight says, "So they got up and fled in the dusk and abandoned their tents and their horses and their donkeys and left the camp as it was and ran for their lives." So what did those starving lepers do? They pounced on whatever food and drink they could find and gorged themselves, doubtless. Then they gathered the other plunder, gold and silver and clothes, and went and hid it, returned for more, and hid that too. And then these poor creatures had a thought. And it is this, I think, which is perhaps the most moving part of the story. Wonder what you think. These outcasts, utterly despised by Israel, had a thought for those who had been so sorely tried with the siege and the famine in Samaria. They had a thought of those who utterly despised them and had done for so long. Notice what the lepers say. "We are not doing right." Now, what had such pathetic souls to do with doing right when life was so miserable for them as complete outcasts? Well, they still had sound moral notions in their breasts. They were, in fact, noble souls to think of others when their own lives were so miserable and hazardous. And I think there is a wonderful lesson for us there. It is the mind and heart of man which makes him truly human, not his outward physical condition. And thinking of that, you know, we must be careful. We are so often engrossed with outward things. And for all the emphasis on the belief, which I hold very definitely, that our outward appearance should correspond with our inward experience. It is not clothes that make the man, or even physical well-being. Our old poet again, the heart's eye, the part eye, that makes us right or wrong. And the hearts of these poor outcasts were right. So, they went to the royal palace, called out the city gatekeepers, told them about the flight and complete departure of the Syrian army, and had the king roused from his bed to receive the news. He was, of course, dubious. They've withdrawn, said he skeptically. They have withdrawn, these Syrians, to prepare an ambush. And when we go out to recover the spoil, they will descend on us. What do you think of that as an unbelieving response? Especially when four lepers were bold enough to approach the royal palace, which was a very daring thing for them to do, and created a stir by going to the palace. Would you not think that even the king might have believed that God had wrought another miracle? No. This king knew so little of the God of Israel that his fear of the Syrians was far greater than his confidence in the Lord. After all, had he not said, the disaster was come from the Lord. And they were tired of waiting for the Lord to come and intervene. So he had already given up hope. And that we must never do. The thing about a real child of God is that he never, repeat, never gives up hope. This is the remarkable thing about the psalmists. It matters not however much whining and moaning there has been in some of the more painful psalms. There must be only one or two in the whole Psalter, even of that, which do not end in buoyant hope. Well then, said the skeptical monarch, let five men with horses go and see what had happened. He reckoned that if these were lost, that would be better than sending a whole army to be pounced upon by an ambushing army. But what they found was that as far as the River Jordan, the way was cluttered with the Syrians' equipment, accoutrements, and armor. They must have been absolutely terrified at the sound, as if the very devil were after them, for them to drop everything that belonged to them and run as if their lives depended on it. But there was nothing there to alarm them but this great noise. It's exciting, isn't it? What the Lord is willing to do supernaturally to achieve his ends. So, on receiving intelligence of the complete departure of the Syrian army, the people went out, and retrieving the Syrians' discarded wealth, including their food stores, which of course was much more important to the starving inhabitants of Samaria than silver and gold and clothes. They fed. So that by the end of that day, food commodities were available to the inhabitants, and apparently practically at normal prices. But what about the cynical officer who doubted that such a thing could happen even if God opened the floodgates of heaven and poured out a blessing? He thought that even the Lord could not provide food in that situation, in a beleaguered city, and at normal prices too? No. But it happened, and the officer saw it. But you remember the prophet's warning that although he would see what he didn't believe was possible, he wouldn't share in it. And that was because the stampede for food was so great that he was knocked down and trampled to death, so that he never tasted a morsel of the food these people enjoyed as presumably they prepared for their beds. Wonderful, wonderful. You see, in a world of grace, it is dangerous to be cynical, dangerous to be unbelieving. It's not on. It mustn't be. We mustn't do it. We're in danger of being run over if we don't believe the Lord is coming with abundant supplies, just because he delays his coming to the last desperate minute. We must learn to hold on. For you see, that is the overwhelming message of the Psalter, the Psalms. We must in all circumstances hold on to God and hold on to his word. Take the very worst psalms of complaint about the Lord's delays, when his servants are so agonizingly waiting for his succor, and we find practically no failure of hope at all. Read the psalms through and see. Of course, you couldn't expect a nominal king and a skeptical army officer to enter into the thrill of Elisha's prediction. He was living in a world of grace, was the prophet. The prophet Elisha was living in a world of grace in which his God could literally do anything he chose to do. Well, we need to go back, you know, to origins when we doubt the Lord. He made all these stars whirling in space in such ordered procession. if he did that and made them all out of nothing? Is there anything less that he can not do if he wants to? He can do anything. You know, when we become doubtful, instead of charging God either with impotence or with not caring, we should give him the benefit of our doubt and credit him with knowing what he is doing and leave it to him, even when we are most desperate. I want to give you an example of how the Lord does that. Look at what he has done recently for our congregation. You know that for over 40 years, the Students' Committee of Presbytery would not allow a divinity student to be officially attached to Kilcomston because they said there was nothing for a divinity student to learn with us since we didn't have a plethora of social clubs and organizations. And the fact that perhaps more divinity students have gone through Gilcomston in 51 years than perhaps through any congregation in Scotland, and if there's a competitor with that, it might very well be Holyrood Abbey. That fact hasn't weighed at all with the Students' Committee all these 40 years. And even when I appealed to the presbytery when they congratulated me on 50 years of ordination, the committee simply ignored what I said. Until, that is, they had a change of heart, due doubtless to certain gracious influences working on them. And they graciously agreed to let us have this young man, William Philip, to help us during his final year in divinity. After all these years of refusal of our witness, and in our congregation, the change of heart has seemed as massive a turn around, volt face, they call it, as massive a turnaround as God's eventual dealing with Israel. It's a wonder. You never know what the Lord will do even after 40 or more years. That's why we sang last Sunday morning Psalm 126. You remember? When the Lord brought back the captives to Zion, we were like men that dreamed. Our mouths were filled with laughter and our tongues with songs of joy. Then it was said among the nations, the Lord has done great things for them. And so we concur with that, as in the psalm. The Lord has done great things, other things than that, of course, but he has done that for us. And we are filled with joy. And I think, therefore, in closing our service, we should sing Psalm 126. And I wanted Drew to choose perhaps the merriest true tune he could find, and perhaps the one that Tom Swanson named after my sister, Barbara, will do. Psalm 126.